Now, Colum Tobin has also just come out with a new book. It's an appreciation of the American poet Elizabeth Bishop. She's always been kind of a writer's writer, a poet whose work faded from popularity after her death, but there's been a resurgence of interest in her lately. Tobin says he has admired her for years and even feels a kind of kinship with her. Steve Paulson asked him to read a passage from the new book.
She began with the idea that little is known and that much is puzzling. The effort then to make a true statement in poetry, to claim something is something or does something, required a hushed, solitary concentration. A true statement for her carried with it, buried in its rhythm, considerable degrees of irony, because it was oddly futile. It was either too simple or too loaded to mean a great deal. It did not do anything much other than distract or briefly please the reader. Nonetheless, it was essential for Elizabeth Bishop that the words in a statement be precise and exact.
Colum, you have been reading Elizabeth Bishop's poems for years. Why does her work resonate so strongly for you?
I suppose I found when I started to read her in the 1970s that while much was left out, in other words, there are really no confessional autobiographical poems, that within the rhythms, much is implied and left in. So there's a battle going on between, I suppose, austerity, reticence, and some way of allowing in vast amounts of ambiguous feeling, which would be contained in the poem, expressed in the poem, but not necessarily stated in the poem categorically or precisely.
So she's the opposite of those very confessional poets. I don't know, Sylvia Plath, someone like that.
While she tolerated to some extent Robert Lowell's confessional poems, he was a friend of hers, and she put up with that, and she praised those poems, but she really didn't like, for example, the poetry of Anne Sexton, or indeed Plath, or indeed she found, for example, the misery poems of Philip Larkin unconvincing. She was all for misery, she said, but you can't just write it down. You have to sort of win the reader by approaching it in an oblique sort of way.
Well, John Ashbery called her a writer's writer, which I'm not sure.
I think that's changed.
I don't know if that's praise or not.
Well, it was a joke. I mean, James Merrill said about her that she did a lifelong imitation of an ordinary woman. I think they were all fascinated by her. But that John Ashbery statement, I think things have really changed since then. Because when he was talking about her, she was somebody that very few people had read. And they tended to be poets, and they tended to be quite rarefied poets. But now she's a very big audience. I mean, her books actually sell, and her poems are known. And her poems are canonical, so she's moved from the shadows very effectively into the center of American poetry.
Can you give me a brief outline of Elizabeth Bishop's life?
She was born in 1912. There was a great division in class between her parents. Her father was from a very rich family, and her mother was a school teacher from a small village in Nova Scotia. Her father died when she was 6 months old. At the age of five, when Bishop was five, her mother was incarcerated in a mental hospital where she lived for the rest of her life. Bishop never saw her again. Bishop was brought up by her Nova Scotia side of the family for some years until she was taken to Boston by the Boston side. And then everything emerged, the eczema, the asthma, the deep unhappiness. And, I mean, she was lesbian. She generally had a partner. But the big love affair really happened when she went to Brazil in the early 1950s, and she fell in love with a very rich Brazilian woman and a very glorious sort of woman who was in the higher echelons of Brazilian society, a woman called Lota de Macedo Soares. And they were together for about 15 years. They had a whale of a time in Brazil. Then eventually things fell apart, and Lota committed suicide in New York. And I think she left Bishop really forlorn. Bishop went back eventually to New England, and she taught at Harvard, and then ended up living in Boston, where she died in 1979.
Now, clearly, you see some similarities between her life and your own life, and this is something you write about quite a bit in your book, starting with where each of you grew up. What are some of the parallels?
I grew up in County Wexford, which has sea on two sides. It's rural Ireland, and people have very good manners. They are very careful what they say. They're very watchful. I found a lot of that in Nova Scotia, and indeed in Bishop's poems about Nova Scotia. People talk in hushed voices. People hint at things rather than declare them.
So this is a language of restraint. I mean, you don't sort of, everything is understated.
Yes. That's correct. And I lost my father. My father got sick when I was 8 and died when I was 12. Plus I'm gay, which Bishop was. So, I mean, I have all of that. But also, I suppose in the prose I write, I tend to write pretty, pared back sentences. I don't write big, long sort of Moby Dick sentences. And, I might have got that from Bishop in some way, but also I recognize something in Bishop that was in myself.
Well, we should quote something from Bishop's own poetry, and maybe you could read something from what is probably her most famous poem, One Art.
Yeah, her most famous poem is called One Art. It's villanelle, meaning that it uses systems of repetition. The first line is, "The art of losing isn't hard to master." And then she finds rhyme words for that, like disaster. And she takes you through all the things she lost, which begins with keys and small things. And these are the last two stanzas of the poem. And of course, she's been describing small things she lost. And now she's moving into the big things. "I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I own, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. The art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster." And when people saw that poem, they thought that finally she had said what the problems were about losing. But actually, she doesn't mention her father or her mother. She doesn't mention, this is written after Lotus' suicide, she doesn't mention that either. So it's a sort of almost a whimsical poem where she's trying to write about something serious while actually holding back and leaving out quite a lot.
Now, one of the great pleasures of your book is how you weave your own personal history into your writing about Elizabeth Bishop. And you say, for instance, that you also have a close relationship with silence, with things withheld, with things known and not said. Can you tell me more about that, about how that figures into your own sensibility?
You often wonder if people could feel things more deeply or indeed express them more deeply by being very careful with them and reticent and withholding, where there are things you simply don't want to write about. You feel that they come to you so ambiguously, that they come like waves because they go out again. So I think something like grief is something that people will recognize as being, it's often there in the morning, say. By the afternoon, it seems to have gone. You know it's coming back, but you don't know when. I think that's an interesting thing to write about, rather than writing about grief as though it's one single set of feelings. So, I mean, for me, sometimes not writing about things that really matter to me, and certainly not talking about them. I mean, I know that we live in an age where you're meant to, even with the most casual acquaintance, sit down and tell them all about how you feel this week. Well, I don't tend to do that.
So do you think talking about these things kind of takes away from the real experience?
I think if certain things happen to you and you feel them very deeply, you can become very uneasy about having them soiled by speech, that somehow or other speech is just not accurate enough, that language is simply not clear enough.
Now, you've mentioned her friendship with an even more famous poet, Robert Lowell, and they knew each other for a long time, communicated mostly by letters. Clearly, there was a great deal of mutual affection, of admiration, and also, it would seem, some competitiveness. How would you describe their relationship?
Well, she admired his work enormously, and he admired her work. And they're always writing to each other to say how much they admired one another's work. But the last big argument between them was really a very serious one. When Lowell's marriage broke up, and he was living in London, and his wife, Elizabeth Hardwick, is the wife he'd broken up from, she wrote him these heartbroken letters. And Lowell decided to make the letters into sonnets and publish them without a permission. And Bishop wrote him a very stern letter. And what she said, I think, is an interesting moment in the history of freedom of expression and censorship. She said to him, "Look, don't let anyone tell you these are not art. Whatever you've managed to do to these letters, you've made art. This is art. But what you have to remember is it isn't worth it." And, we always are made feel, no matter what it is, if it's art, it's worth, you can do anything for the sake of art. She said, not this time. That, she said, "What you've done is infinite mischief by taking these private letters and making them into public sonnets."
Hmm. Now, you also draw some parallels between Bishop and your fellow Irishman, James Joyce, two writers who, of course, chose self-imposed exile. And you have a lovely passage where you describe some of those connections. And could you read it?
Yeah, right, okay. In Joyce's Irish Catholic world, and in the beliefs of Bishop's Baptist upbringing, the relationship to God is stark, almost simple. When faith disappears, as it did with these two writers, then the language of transcendence can have a special power because it invokes something that was once familiar, once possible, and is now lost. Faith goes, language remains. Slowly the new faithless language takes on a power much greater than it ever had when it was there merely to express faith. Language is all there is now. And in the ambiguous space created by a precise and exact evocation of the past, a single concluding image, the image of the snow in Joyce and the quasi-religious images of water in Bishop, is allowed to soar above the ordinary universe like a hymn or an aria, something filled with rising cadence. A sort of homecoming is enacted by allowing the image to transform itself, free itself from the shackles of the concrete, the positive, the world of things, and move like a boat sent to rescue someone into an uneasy, shimmering, almost philosophical, almost religious space, using words with both freedom and restraint, suggesting something that has not been formulated or imagined by anyone before.
That's the Irish novelist Colm Tobin talking with Steve Paulson about his new book on Elizabeth Bishop.